Hello, friends. I'm Zen Hess. You're listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast from Baylor's Religion Department and Baylor University Press. Welcome to summer school. This season has episodes about what it's like to be on a Bible translation committee and how academic religious scholars write their books. We have episodes discussing how interviews add to historical research and about how scholars are thinking with Paul about environmental ethics. In this episode, I'm speaking with four outstanding Baylor faculty about how they're nurturing connections between religious scholars and psychologists. Happy listening. How might psychology help religious scholars think about human suffering, about virtues, or about aesthetics? How might the scientific research methods of psychological science aid theologians and biblical scholars in their research? Four Baylor faculty and 17 participants from universities across America have started exploring these sorts of questions. Their research is funded through a $2.5 million John Templeton Foundation grant. Here's the big picture, as described on the project's website. This grant aims to foster interdisciplinary work that brings together scholars from various fields to tackle complex problems of human flourishing. In today's episode, the four women overseeing this project join me to discuss the project and their hopes for it. Up first, you'll hear my conversation with the primary investigators, Dr. Sarah Schnitker and Dr. Devin Stahl. Sarah is Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience here at Baylor, and Devin is Associate Professor of Religion and the editor of Bioenhancement Technologies and the Vulnerable Body, which will be published with Baylor Press this fall. Dr. Sarah Schnitker, welcome to Currents in Religion.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Devin Stahl, welcome back to Currents in Religion for the third time.
Thanks for having me back.
First of all, congratulations to both of you and your team for securing a massive grant, $2.5 million, to do really exciting things. Just lead in. Tell us what this grant is for. What is it going to do?
Yeah, so this is a John Templeton Foundation grant, and the initial call for the grant was cross-training between Christian theologians and the psychological sciences. So how can we get Christian theologians to understand something about psychological science? And when I saw that call, and I think Sarah and I had a sense that this call was coming. We had already been friends before we applied for this grant. I saw it and thought, this is too perfect. I have a friend who is a psychologist. I do Christian theology. I understand, as a bioethicist, the strengths of interdisciplinary work. Wouldn't it be great if I got to work with my friend Sarah to help train theologians in the work that she does so that we can learn from one another? And we just thought, we're like, not only are we the perfect pair, we're at the perfect like institution to do this, because Baylor has such a strong religion department, such a strong seminary, and such a strong psychology department that we just seem like the perfect site to do a grant like this.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, it was funny because when the call came out, I just told my lab, like, don't let me write another grant proposal. Do not let me do one. We are full. We have plenty to do, but it was, again, just, we can't pass this up. And I think it's not so much that I needed it for my career, but just to say, like, this needs to be happening at Baylor.
Yeah.
Baylor, as kind of the flagship Protestant R1, we should be the site of this kind of integrative work.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't resist.
I love that. So beyond being friends, as a theologian and bioethicist and as a psychologist, was there like an aha moment for either one of you before the grant that triggered for you, like, man, it would be really beneficial for a more robust engagement between theological studies and psychological studies.
Yeah. Well, before coming to Baylor, I was on the faculty at Fuller Seminary for 8 years.
Cool.
So this was something that a lot of my early time as a faculty was very much inherent in what I was trying to do, and really grew to value there just the richness of the conversations with theology.
Mm-hmm.
One, just because it's enjoyable, but also how it made my science so much better.
Yeah.
Because we're really more careful with our conceptualizations and thinking about, there's a rich intellectual tradition here in religion that psychologists are not always attending to.
Sure.
And actually, when I got here to Baylor in 2018, pretty quickly, we started a kind of informal colloquium, gathering people across all of the schools and different departments. And Devin got involved in that pretty early on, where we just came together to talk about topics like human flourishing, bringing together philosophy, psychology, religion, sociology, just people in the business school even, of we cannot stay siloed if we're actually going to do excellent research on topics around human flourishing in particular. We have to be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I don't know if that's how we first met, or I knew someone I knew from that group, so like, oh, you need to meet Devin. And then it kept going.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, so I do this other work in bioethics that requires me to understand a little bit of medical science. But as you know, and I've talked about on a previous podcast, I do a lot of work in disability. And for me, disability can't be regulated to just medical science. And as I was asking kind of deep theological questions about, you know, what does it mean to be disabled, and how are disabled people being perceived in congregations and in other social spaces? These are questions that aren't just theological and aren't just medical. They're real psychological questions.
Yeah.
So how are people understanding themselves, understanding their bodies? How are we perceiving like the divine in relationship to that embodiment? I mean, psychology just makes so much sense as a science for Christian theology to turn to when it's making presumptions about how it is that we understand ourselves and our behaviors and our apprehensions. And so that's kind of how we wrote the grant too, is this is the perfect science. If we're going to be using science in theology, psychology just makes so much sense as a science to draw on, because it's all about humans. And as a theologian, I think a lot about humans too.
Yeah, I hope so. Yes. So then, okay, tell us a little bit about the logistics of the grant. What are the phases, and how will these phases equip theologians and psychologists to work together?
Yeah. Well, I feel like I've got the phase that...
Sarah's the phase master.
The phase master over here. and, you know, and part of the reason we made a phased approach, so I've written and administered a couple grants in the past where we had these requests for proposals and re-granting of money to individuals. And you find that sometimes people don't realize what they're getting into.
Yeah.
Or don't actually, like, once they realize, like, oh, maybe I didn't want to do that. So we saw the phased approach as really an opportunity, especially with something like this, to be like, more informed consent before you have to go deeper down this trail. So you're not getting in over your head and doing things that actually aren't for you.
Nice.
As many of our grantees, might be the first time they're really engaging psychology. Not all of them, but some. And so in this first phase that just really launched here in May with our gathering we had of about 20 theologians and philosophers, this phase one is really about kind of general introduction, getting to know psychological science.
Sure.
These two Maymesters that are each 5 days, plus we'll have a lot of virtual meetings throughout this next academic year. We're getting to know each other, getting to know the topography of the psychological landscape, where there's traction, who you might want to be talking to. Because then in phase two, a certain number of people will move forward to actually do what we call a scholar in lab residency.
Okay.
So in psychology, and this is often a fun thing to realize when you start doing this interdisciplinary work with the humanities, right? We're all about teams.
Yeah.
And team science and labs and people are like, do you have like beakers? What does it mean you have a lab, right? It's more of a group of people and really getting embedded within a research lab and learning all the pieces that go into actually doing a study and what it looks like on the ground. And that then prepares them for the third phase where with that psychologist, they've been working in their lab, they propose a study together for a 1-year research study. They're not going to be able to do the huge study of all time, more just to find integrative questions that both the scholars care about.
Yeah.
And to try your hand at like, how do I take my theological ideas and move it into what psychologists can do and what can I learn from it?
Yeah.
So,
So phase one, May 23 to May 24, is really kind of introductions to the conversation of psychology for folks in theological studies, kind of broadly construed. But it also seems like this first stage that y'all are in right now would be kind of brilliant on its own because of the networking that's taking place between people within theological studies who are interested in integrating psychological research and method into their approach. Does that seem right to you all?
That's exactly right. So part of one of our big aims in this first phase, all the phases, but especially this first phase, is just academic friendship.
Yeah.
So there's not there's not that many theologians who are interested in working in these kinds of sciences. And so when you can find like-minded people, it's really fun to get to know them and to know the different projects they're doing. And we phase this around three kind of areas. One is this kind of what I was talking about, this area we called suffering, suffering and well-being. The second is around the virtues, and Sarah's just the preeminent scholar in this area of virtue, and then aesthetics and the arts. So I'm getting to know all these amazing people who are interested in the sciences in the way that I am, who are working on projects that are captivating. That's so cool. And then we also then get to make academic friendships with the, 20 psychologists that Sarah brought over to talk with us about the things that we're interested in, that they are also interested in. So creating this sort of network of friendship within the academy of people that you might not otherwise have known. Some are in Baylor, but most of them are outside of Baylor. And it's really cool to get to know people that way.
Yeah, I love that. So tell us a little bit more about the themes that you just mentioned. So suffering, aesthetics, and virtues. How did you land on those topics? And how is it playing out to have these themes in the phases of the grant?
Yeah, I think some of it was practical and some of it was theoretical. And Sarah can chime in too with how she was thinking about it. We wanted to delimit kind of the scope of it. So we were thinking, if it's so broad, maybe it's hard to get your hands around. And so themes kind of make sense to apply into. I do the work on suffering, so that made sense to me. But also, the idea of like well-being and flourishing makes a lot of sense with psychology. The virtues, like I said, Sarah's a virtue scholar, and psychologists are interested in, especially positive psychologists, in how to strengthen people in those ways. So virtues makes a lot of sense. And then arts and aesthetics is, as I understand it, a growing area within psychology. It's like, what do the arts do to us psychologically? Yeah. It's a big area that our good friend Natalie Carnes is working in, and it made sense for she wanted to be involved, and it made sense both like as a thematic area and as an expert in that area to have her lead that area. So it was both like, who do we have at Baylor who's already doing this work? How does it already play into the kind of trends within psychology? And how can we make all of that work with who we have?
Yeah.
And I would add too, I think we see this grant, right? We're not going to do the most amazing research ever, but it's really about forming these relationships and thinking about what grant proposals could come out of this.
Yeah.
And so part of our choices too, we're thinking about the funding landscape and looking at where the fields are headed, but also what is research that we know people are interested in investing in.
Yeah,
in this country and internationally, and trying to prepare kind of, it's all this your starter for collaborations, right? The little yeast starter for the sourdough bread. How do we get the right people together?
Yeah. It seems like you have played to some of the strengths of Baylor as an institution, but we're of the 20-ish scholars, were all of them Baylor faculty, or where are they coming from? Who's making up the group of phase one?
Yeah.
So six of our participants are internal to Baylor.
Okay.
And that's various places throughout the university. Truett, religion, philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then we have 11 external. And they come from, none of them come from the same place.
Oh, cool.
So really all over the country. We had a few international applicants. We ended up with domestic applicants, but really from all over the country, from Christian institutions, from secular institutions, mm-hmm. bigger universities, smaller universities, teaching a variety of different things in theology, philosophy, ethics, Bible. So really a variety of folks.
Yeah.
And then, and of course, we have Devin, Anne, and Natalie as three of our scholars as well. So that's how you get to your 20.
There you go. Okay. Got it.
And I think, too, it's really interesting to see all the places, like, we have our ones, but then we also have the niche schools. Just, I feel like this kind of innovative work springs up from a lot of different locations.
Yeah.
And it's not always the thing that's most incentivized in the academy. So it's fun to see where people are kind of lurking, just waiting to be able to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm kind of thinking about the way that at least I've imagined the grant when I've heard it talked about as being kind of psychology informing theology. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if it's imagined by you all as you're thinking through this as really more of a kind of two-way street where theology brings its own gifts and assets to the study of psychology too, or how does that
definitely
work?
Definitely. I mean the call was for training of the theologian.
Right.
So
yeah.
it's got that way.
Focus,
but
yes.
I think it's very much, I know even before this, I was involved in several cross-training grants funded by Templeton, and it really goes both ways, and it works best when everyone is taking the posture of like, I want to learn something new.
Yeah.
And I think it's important too for each discipline to retain its distinctiveness.
Absolutely. Of course.
But to really understand that there's something that can be added from the other discipline. And I think even in our Maymester, some of the psychologists, some of them have really worked across disciplines before, not all of them. And they were like, this is fun. we're sharpening things and I have new research ideas. And and that's part of the reason too for our kind of lab-based residencies.
Okay.
It's not just for the theologian, but it's also to expose grad students, postdocs to a new way of doing their science and maybe from their training to actually say, oh, this is something valuable.
Right.
I need to learn how to have this conversation. I can do that now and then actually seek it out in the future.
Yeah. So I've kind of had us hovering over phase one here a little bit, but you've just called back to the lab parts of at least phase three. So give us just a little bit more kind of insight to what phase two will look like coming next summer. Yeah.
I'd say what exactly it looks like will be variable depending on which research lab someone's joining.
Yeah.
So, you know, and different psychologists have very different kinds of labs. So it might be one scholar joins a lab that's doing research with children and they're bringing kids into the lab and they're watching how you would run participants in that way and doing things there. It could be in another lab, it's more online studies and more about writing and analyzing data in complex ways. And we don't anticipate that the theologians are going to necessarily do all these tasks.
Sure.
But really observing, being a part of lab meetings, being part of the conversation. And we also ask them to do a bit of writing of kind of thinking about a journal article that can bring what they're learning about in psychological science to theology. And my goal, like what I would prefer is that these are co-authored, right? So that the psychologist and theologian are writing together.
Yeah.
I've done this many times and it's really rich in the hard work of actually fitting them together. You have to put it on the paper. So it leads to a different level of engagement.
Yeah, right.
So I think that will be a big component too of what they're doing there.
Cool.
And we're all excited about it because the psychologists laugh at us, but we're like, what do you do all day? And I'm like, well, I mostly sit in my office. We're like in my office right now, and I read my books, yep. and I take notes, and I write papers. And so much of that is really solitary. We rarely do, and right. you know, theology, qua theology rarely is done in a team. Mm-hmm. It rarely talks to people, right?
Right.
We're talking to like the early church, or we're talking to our, you know, Reformation colleagues. We're talking to a bunch of dead people in books,
yeah.
right? And the idea of doing it with people is both like intimidating for a lot mm-hmm. of folks, but also really exciting to share our knowledge, to have to translate it into a new way, to get out of the office, our windowless office, and like see new things. Yeah. It's both exciting and I think will open up new avenues for theologians who can get kind of stuck doing things in one way.
Yeah.
I mean, even the process of co-authoring, like every time it's an adventure, mm-hmm. but realizing you have to make so many things explicit
yeah.
that you don't even realize you do, of like, how do you like to write a paper? Like, yeah. I have to have this conversation anytime I start writing with someone new, and none of my papers are single author. So
yeah.
even just also, I think, learning about your own process mm-hmm. a little bit more when you have something different next to it is,
yeah.
I find that fun, but I guess I'm a psychologist.
So. It just depends on your partner, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I think
true.
So. I think so. It is really something to think about. I mean, the way that if I were to go through, you know, science journals more generally, there typically are just a handful of authors at least. But theology journals, biblical studies journals, it's a rare thing to see a co-authored essay. I'll be interested to see how those co-authored pieces come together. I think that's a good thing to encourage scholars to. And then, so phase two is being in a lab for observation and some writing engagement. Mm-hmm. And then phase three is a more intensive kind of partnership between one of the participants and a psychologist.
And more than one. We have about six teams that will actually do research studies.
Okay.
So we have not only funds for them to get course buyouts, to have the time, but actual money to pay participants.
Oh my goodness.
Or to pay for materials or
yeah.
what the thing we need to actually do this stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is where I get most excited because that's yeah. where I live. But I think it's from like experiences. So I've done a cross training with Tim Paul, who's a philosopher at University of St. Thomas, for
okay.
instance. And we had done a lot of writing together, and then it's like, okay, let's actually design a study together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so fun to sit there and like make experimental manipulations. And he has things he wants because of like the precision of the concept.
Right.
But I'm like, these are real human beings who went to assume maybe a seventh grade reading level. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
can't. So, and like, oh, and here's the problem with that psychologically. Mm-hmm. That's now not congruent. Like, just that process.
Yeah.
I know he said to me, like, oh, I see why things are done a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And why I get frustrated with y'all sometimes that like, why can't you stick to the concept more? But you have all these pressures. And,
yeah.
I mean, psychologists are very pragmatic because it's just mm-hmm. a constant balance.
Yeah.
So yeah. That should be fun.
Yeah, it sounds fun. And I'm really thrilled that this is happening here at Baylor. I'm really thrilled that you all, along with Drs. Carnes and Jeffrey, are leading this all up. Thanks for taking some time to give us a window into what you're doing with this really cool grant.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, just a quick break so we can tell you a little bit more about Devin Stahl's forthcoming book from Baylor University Press. I am here once again with Cade Jarrell, Assistant Director and Managing Editor at Baylor University Press. Cade, tell us about another book.
Yeah, glad to be back. Excited about this one. So we're absolutely thrilled to have our Baylor colleague, Devin Stahl, on our list this year. She's editing this volume, Bioenhancement Technologies in the Vulnerable Body. So Devin has become a prominent figure, as mm-hmm. you know, in the field of theological bioethics.
And a three-time guest on Currents in Religion.
Right, yes. That's right. She's a rock star.
That's right.
She's already done some great work here at Baylor, advancing that conversation. So this edited volume represents an exciting new direction for Baylor Press's list. She has assembled a team of expert theologians and ethicists to tackle this issue of bioenhancement. So at the heart of the volume's moral concern is the place of minority populations, hence the vulnerable body, their place in this ongoing medical and ethical debate about the value and validity of technological bioenhancement. In short, the idea is marginalized persons have not been sufficiently factored into these conversations. You know, when we're talking about health and what it means to have a fully flourishing life, you know, especially when the healthcare system is honestly set up to disparage those mm-hmm. marginalized communities. So a lot of important questions are tackled here, from the foundational issue of personhood, all the way to transhumanism, and then you factor in race and gender, and then there's also some good disability theology factored in. It's a cutting edge project, and we believe will help push this conversation forward in a way rooted in specifically Christian conviction.
Bioenhancement Technologies and the Vulnerable Body, out this fall with Baylor University Press. Thanks, Cade.
Yep, thanks, Ed.
All right, so now you're going to hear from the two co-investigators, Dr. Anne Jeffrey and Dr. Natalie Carnes. Anne is assistant professor of philosophy here at Baylor, and Natalie is associate professor of religion, also here at Baylor University. Dr. Natalie Carnes, welcome back to Currents in Religion.
Thanks for having me, Zen.
And Dr. Anne Jeffrey, thank you for joining us for the first time on Currents in Religion.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we heard from Dr. Schnitker and Stahl about the logistics of the grant, its phases and themes, and those sorts of details. But I hope that you two might give us a closer look at how the grant is already facilitating conversations between theologians and psychologists, or maybe philosophers of religion and other folks in theological studies broadly construed. So in May of 2023, you all hosted a week-long cross-training intensive. Tell us a little bit more about that week. Who was there and what happened?
So we gathered 17 professors, mostly early career, some mid-career, a couple established professors. And they came from all over the country, universities, liberal arts colleges, seminaries, from the fields of theology and philosophy of religion, to engage with psychologists. And the idea was that they, through engaging psychology, would learn to pursue new questions or to pursue the same questions in new ways, mm-hmm. or generally just open up new areas of research that come from engaging a different kind of field.
Awesome. So how did the psychologists help theologians and others do that?
Yeah, in a variety of ways. So our psychologists here at Baylor who helped facilitate the cross-training week are phenomenal teachers. I think that was really fun for, you know, me as a colleague who sees them present research to see them turn on teacher mode and engage us actively. They gave us overviews of some of the basic science. I never took psychology in college. I didn't discover it till after grad school. So they were giving us the lay of the land, various types of psychology, social psychology, personality psychology, various methods, experimental methods, qualitative methods, mixed methods, and then also breaking us out into small groups, having us do activities, having us talk together about different ways we use the same terms in theology and psychology, respectively. And then having some time for consultations with individuals about their projects and how those might be fruitfully brought together with psychological research.
Yeah. Very cool.
And they were such good teachers. I will just echo that. Yeah. I was like taking pedagogical notes, the way that they integrated, for example, like writing time into, like, you've had a whole day full of materials. And so here's some time where you can go and sort of process it by having a little bit of writing time together. Or they would put us in sort of different small groups where we would learn with different people and then break us into different groups where we then process that material that we just learned. So it was like a nice combination where even the lectures, we were given time to like really actively learn with the lectures and sort of try out the ideas by discussing them in various small groups and things, which was really helpful.
That's awesome. I love that. So, Anne, you mentioned that you didn't really study psychology in undergrad, but you have, since graduate school, kind of found your way into some psychological research and the psychological sciences as a part of your discipline as a philosopher. Could you tell us a little bit more about, with some of that background, what this intensive cross-training experience was like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had the privilege of working with a psychologist at University of South Alabama, who's now at Vanderbilt, Krista Mahari, for 2 years on a project. We collaborated in testing and developing a program for adolescents to grow in virtues that were valued by their community. And we had a lot of learning opportunities, I guess, to kind of learn how to do interdisciplinary research as we were doing it. And I think that also being at Baylor and being part of the Flourishing group here, which is an interdisciplinary group that meets once a week to share research on flourishing across the disciplines, has given me a window into various ways that humanities folks can have conversations that are productive with psychological sciences. And so this week for me felt like an opportunity to sort of deploy some of the skills and knowledge that I've acquired, which is helpful to my own research, but which in philosophy is not always widely valued. There's actually like a lot of heated debate about whether we should be doing experimental philosophy or integrating anything empirical in like moral philosophy. So it was really fun to have a bunch of people who are open-minded about integrating these fields and their methods and to kind of coach them through what it might look like to do that and what areas of psychology might be germane to what they're already studying, how to think about what parts of their research programs are already kind of laden with empirical assumptions that they could then test or look to empirical research that's already been done to validate or invalidate.
Yeah. Excellent. And Natalie, you are kind of at the forefront, it seems, of theologians trying to engage in this kind of interdisciplinary work with psychological sciences. Is that true?
No.
No.
I would not say that. I would say...
Anne said that.
Anne,
I was lied to in the pre-interview.
Her friendship love goggles. No, I would say that there has been a recent shift in my specific subfield of theology and the arts with Templeton Religion Trust, which is not the same organization that funded us, which was John Templeton Foundation, but TRT... a few years ago, opened up a new funding stream called Art Seeking Understanding, where they were encouraging people who work in theology and the arts to engage not just psychological sciences, but a number of different sciences, including psychological science. So I would say that psychology, among other sciences, has come to that subfield of mine quite recently. And so there aren't a lot of people who had done it before 2020. And now there's like a number of people who have done it. And I did not like PI any of those projects, but I was related to and involved in them in kind of more tangential ways and some of the more substantial ways. And so I got to see a lot of how it is different, more scientifically oriented disciplines can enrich questions around aesthetics and theology. And what's quite well established in theology are conversations around religion and science.
Yeah.
I mean, and they've taken all different kinds of shapes over. I mean, they've been going on. Well, we could argue they've been going on since the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Just where science has meant different kinds of things and mapped out different kinds of territory. But in particular, there's been a movement funded a lot by Templeton towards science engaged theology, which is meant several different things. And one of the ways I've recently been involved with that is through engaging philosophers of science and a science engaged theology grant to think about causality. So I mean, that was a really interesting experience for me because I do really enjoy interdisciplinary work, but my inclinations toward interdisciplinarity tend towards the more humanistic disciplines, towards engaging literature, towards engaging art history. And so I noticed through engaging the sciences that the interdisciplinarity has a different kind of shape. It's a different kind of conversation. Yeah. So whereas we in the humanities, like we're constantly, for example, contesting our canon and even the very idea of canon, such that our conversations are can be quite are, like our field is just sprawling. And like even the terms on which you have a conversation are always like under review. And mm-hmm. it makes progress quite difficult. It means you have really you're always sort of have something that your ideas are constantly being sort of held up to interrogation, which I think is interesting, but it means also you don't have the same kind of progress that you have when you engage the sciences. So finding this new interdisciplinary was interesting for me. Like, oh, like in the science, when you engage the sciences, there's this real understanding of like what it means to make progress, and that there's a sense in which there's a real public character to your work. Like one psychologist can come to another psychologist and be like, oh, look at how your study has this particular flaw in it, because there's an understanding of like what a good study looks like, how studies are run, and where you have literature that you should have engaged, but you didn't, or which in theology, all of those things would be sort of up for contest. And so then there's a different kind of accountability with your scholarship. Yeah. So I think the whole I've been like intrigued in my late coming to this kind of interdisciplinarity, just how what a different kind of shape the conversation has, and how one really exciting aspect for me is the way that shape of how it has accountability, how it has a kind of publicness to it, how it makes a sense of progress, also invites a real collaboration. And I think that sense of collaboration was one of the most exciting things to me about our week, people talking together about their projects and working in groups, maybe even finding potential pairs for someone they might work with. And that was really energizing, I think.
So as you were engaging in those conversations and those sessions with other participants, what were some of the things that you were seeing come to the front, things that participants were really intrigued by?
I think for the virtue group, something that stood out to me was the interest bubbling up from several of our kind of small group participants in the way that social roles mediate which sort of features could count as a virtue. That is, which features could contribute to human flourishing and to the common good. I think they're virtues very individualistically, and to kind of take on the Aristotelian view that there's one set of virtues for all humankind. You know, Martha Nussbaum defended a long time ago the universality of the virtues, that they were not relative to cultures, even if they could be kind of thickened up in different ways by different cultures. Some folks recently talking about like Confucian ethics have thought about social roles and virtue, but in kind of Western analytic philosophy, that's not been a theme. And we had people talking about what does it look like to have virtues in situations of scarcity? What does it look like to have solidarity when you're in the position of power? What are the virtues that are peculiar to motherhood, which maybe aren't part of the canonical virtues? Because guess what? Aristotle wasn't experiencing life as a mother, so might not.
Fair enough.
Might not have reflected from the inside about that. What about pride? For people who have been in historically marginalized groups, should that be thought of as a virtue instead of a vice? So that was, you know, several different people were all looking at these themes. And then we were able to talk a little bit about how social psychology that is attending to group dynamics and identity and differences that those identities can make for different outcomes and having traits and those traits bearing on those outcomes kind of make. So I thought that was really exciting and something distinctive that is bubbling up out of this project. Not that we sort of set things up for that, but it has kind of emerged organically.
Yeah, cool. What about the aesthetics group?
Yeah, one really interesting feature of our a lot of our participants, and including our aesthetics people, was how much they were interested in thinking through social issues and problems of our time. So a lot of people in the aesthetics groups were interested in thinking about aesthetics and art and how they interact with race, with gender or patriarchy or misogyny, with climate change. Mm-hmm. So thinking about these like big issues of our time, and theology and the arts as a field has not been great about dealing with the big issues. It's sometimes been more of a like a younger stream of people in theology and the arts who really do want it to engage like all the difficult things of the world, to take us into those realities rather than become a refuge from them. And this, the conversations that I saw happening that week were conversations that gave concrete ways into thinking about that, yeah. right? So, for example, in some fields like feminist theology, there is this intuition that has been in the field since its founding that aesthetics matters, that symbols, imagination, mm-hmm. images matter for how it is you think about God and how it is you therefore organize a society and a church.
Right.
But this intuition hasn't been sort of empirically elaborated at all.
Yeah.
And so some of the questions that people were interested in were about how aesthetics and art matters for creating the conditions of the kind of people and society we want to be.
Yeah.
Like, how exactly did we get our head around what art and aesthetics can do for social and individual change,
mm-hmm.
and how it is it can do that in the best possible ways.
Yeah.
So people right now are just, they're just the very beginnings of yeah. thinking towards their projects, but those were the types of questions and concerns that they were bringing to the table and ways that I haven't seen other places in mm-hmm. theology where those exact kind of questions can be asked.
It's really exciting. So thinking idealistically, what do you hope to see emerge from the grant as a whole? What sorts of things are you looking for to judge or discern the success of this project?
One thing that we have articulated from the proposal stage as a goal of the project is to invest in people, invest in scholars who then have, you know, are afforded experiences mm-hmm. by the funding of the grant and the work of the grant to think differently about the questions of their field, research programs, and how they might be, you know, so for instance, in moral philosophy, not in any way antagonistic to the sciences, but rather like brought into sort of a harmony with
yeah.
what people are doing in the psychological sciences, and to create some shared language or find places where there is shared language and to like build out from there. And so investing in the participants who, for instance, are in the Virtue group to have kind of a long-term research trajectory where they are not in everything that they do, but they have a sort of cast of mind where they're constantly thinking about mm-hmm. like, what are the empirical assumptions that we're making? Or if we really want our work on, for instance, solidarity to matter in the world, then what would we need to do to impact intervention science,
yeah.
right? And program evaluation and so on. So how can we think more concretely about mm-hmm. the sort of theories that we are building and how they might be used in the world to help people or alleviate problems and suffering?
Yeah.
So I think having those people feel like they are part of a network, that they're invested in, that they're is a large group of people mm-hmm. who are all willing to be open to the psychological sciences in the same way and who are curious about the different forms that might take in the future. I think that's one kind of goal that we all share for the
yeah.
project.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like really well put. And I would just add to it, like one interesting thing I heard some psychologists say was like, well, we also need to like be hearing more from you, theologians and philosophers of religion, and we'd like yeah. to learn more from you and your disciplines. And the ones here at Baylor, the psychologists here at Baylor are amazing at that and inviting that kind of conversation, because they've sort of developed those mm-hmm. practices as part of what they do, is have these interdisciplinary conversations. And I guess if I'm sort of thinking about how cool would it be to see even like even beyond the lifespan of this grant, is to open up these channels of interdisciplinary conversation so that we can just have better, richer conversations across psychology, religion, and philosophy. I mean, you know, psychologists are interested in things like studying religion, but how do you identify like where religion is? What counts as religion? Who, yeah. How do you identify who is a mystic? What are the characteristics of a mystic or a fundamentalist? And turns out people in theology and religious studies have thought a lot about these questions. Right. And so being able to have these kind of conversations across our fields, I think will just lead to like better and more interesting work. And I think it also helps us do better work within our own field as well, because we become aware of assumptions that are just embedded in our field that other fields are help us to see and challenge and orient differently around.
Yeah. Well, I'm so excited to see how the grant unfolds for the next couple of years and where it leads all of the respective fields involved. Anne and Natalie, thank you so much for making some time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having us, Zen.
Thank you, Zen.
I am very grateful to all four of our guests today for speaking with us about their project. Also, thanks to Cade for joining again in the fun. And thanks to you for listening. If this episode was interesting to you, send it to someone else who might find it interesting too. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Current so you don't miss future episodes and leave us a review so we know how we're doing. We've got another great episode for you next week where I talk with three different scholars about their writing process, from generating ideas to putting the pen to the page, or the fingers to the keys, I guess. Anyway, come back next week to learn about how academic religious scholars write. Until then, take care.